The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Hadley Baker, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, Special Edition, February 14th, 2020. Lawfare founder Bobby Chesney and Lawfare contributing editor Steve Vladek host the weekly National Security Law Podcast from the University of Texas Law School, a discussion of current national security law developments. In this episode, the third edition of a Lawfare-edited National Security Law podcast, Bobby and Steve discuss a range of topics that we thought would be of interest to listeners. So we are bringing you a distilled version of their conversation. Bobby and Steve talk about the legal side of accusations that President Trump pressured the Justice Department to amend a sentencing recommendation in the case of Roger Stone and his retaliation against Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. They give context about the federal quarantine law as the coronavirus continues to spread globally. And they go over recent war powers developments and a special listener request about the case of Omar Amin. A quick note, Bobby and Steve recorded this conversation on Wednesday, so news about the Flynn case and about the Senate passing war powers legislation are not mentioned in their discussion. It's the Lawfare Podcast Special Edition. The National Security Law Guys talk Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, Roger Stone, and war powers.
Hello from Austin. Welcome to episode 153 of the National Security Law Podcast. We're brought to you by the Strauss Center at the University of Texas. It's Wednesday morning, February 12th, 2020. I'm Bobby Chesney.
I'm Steve Vladek. I have not yet resigned from the Justice Department in protest.
I'm so glad to hear that. We need you in there, Steve, continuing to do your job at the Justice Department.
I mean, John Kravis was a classmate of mine in law school.
Is that right?
And is as good a guy as there comes. Even though he went to Williams, that he and I are friends. Even though he went to Williams, tells you a lot about how good a guy he is.
You wouldn't hold your friendships hostage to policy differences. Why look at us?
Hey, two of my groomsmen went to Williams.
So we obviously are going to have some Trumplandia segment coverage involving the Roger Stone prosecutorial recommendation debacle and the associated debacle. You like that?
I do.
Well, that's a fun one to say. All right, what are we going to do today?
We got Trumplandia. We've got coronavirusing.
Okay, so we will talk about quarantine stuff.
We got more Soleimani legal fallout still.
Yeah, we'll talk about the legalities, including reference to the legislation in the Senate, the war powers legislation that Senator Kaine is and others from both sides of the aisle are raising, if you will. Yes. And what about Omar Amin?
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
That's a listener request. We're going to be responsive to that. What's that?
For once.
Yeah,
and
I know.
Then we're going to have the part of the show called the Steve updates everybody on his ongoing litigation sagas, because there's news in like three different things.
You've got a lot going on. I can't wait to hear what you're actually up to.
Full colors.
We'll explain this podcast.
Half this podcast has full colors.
We'll explain
full colors when we get there. But suffice it to say, I have filed too many briefs as counsel of record in the Supreme Court.
That has definitely been demonstrated. I think you should wallpaper. You should take the covers and like cover your wall with them.
Oh yeah, that's not showy and snobby and self-referential.
Maybe you should do that at home. Let's jump into it. Trumplandia. Quick rundown of what exactly we know has and hasn't happened with what appears to be, and it's hard to understand as anything but, a case of White House pressure on line prosecutors to change their position.
Or even just DOJ, or even just like main office pressure on line
prosecutors. So transmuted clearly through the front office at Main Justice, out to the U.S. Attorney's Office and pressuring and directing, not pressuring, but directing people to change their position on recommended sentence. Unpack that. What then happened?
So Roger Stone, right, was tried, convicted by a jury, right, of several counts of interfering with the federal investigation, of obstructing justice, of threatening a witness. And so Monday, the Justice Department, per standard practice, filed a sentencing recommendation that recommended a sentencing guidelines-based sentence of somewhere between 7 and 9 years, with much of the enhancement coming from the witness intimidation part of the of the charge.
And just to be clear about the guidelines, this is the whole point of the guidelines is to create at least a framework of objectivity and predictability, where you match the standardized numerical assessment of how serious the offense is versus prior history and other factors aggravating or mitigating, and it yields a grid-like framework that tells you, trace this line, that line. Oh, 7 to 9 years is the recommendation in this setting.
And now, it's just a recommendation. The judge is not bound by the recommendation, although there's a whole lot of complicated case law about what the judge has to do to depart from the recommendation. But for those who react to this like, that seems like an awfully long recommendation for a nonviolent crime, well, it's not. I mean...
No, that part's just misinformed. Like, this is... No one denies that this is what the guidelines range says.
That's not true. There are plenty of people on the internet denying that's what the guidelines range
if
says.
If we're going to go there, then I can never say no one. Okay, let me caveat my standard caveat. No one who knows what they're talking about reasonably denies
the principled objection of those who have some modicum of sense about what they're talking about is that the enhancement for the witness intimidation piece was not justified by what was introduced and proven at trial. And all I'm going to say to that is, that may or may not be true. It is hardly out of DOJ's regular daily practice to push for every enhancement for which there is a plausible, even if not 100% open and shut case in a sentencing recommendation. It is not like DOJ has a history of going soft in sentencing recommendations.
Right. Well, especially when someone's, when it goes to the... As it did here, lying to investigators, et cetera.
Right. So the recommendation was signed by the four career DOJ prosecutors, two of whom were permanently in the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office, and two of whom were detailed as special assistant U.S. attorneys to the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office from other offices, one from the Mueller investigation and one from somewhere else in the country, Illinois, Ohio, something.
Right.
By Monday afternoon, there was lots of noise in conservative newsland that the White House was very unhappy with the sentencing. I mean, so the memo itself got news when it hit because a lot of folks were surprised after DOJ had not recommended an especially severe sentence for Michael Flynn when it filed the memo in Flynn's case last month, 6 weeks ago, that this one came down. I don't think hard in comparison to similar crimes.
It was kind of traditional rather than showing
Trumpian,
any. Yeah, right.
And this quickly got picked up by conservative news outlets. And by Monday night, the president was all a Twitter about how unfair this was and how someone had to do something. And,
it really is amazing that the information transmission mechanism, if you can inject an idea that gets picked up
by Fox News,
right, especially Fox, then if it's interesting, there's a decent chance he's going to respond to it and it'll activate him. And he did. He tweeted about it, criticizing it very, very directly.
Directly.
And then what happens?
And then shockingly enough, so by Tuesday morning, there are reports circulating in the news that the main office at DOJ is leaking. The front office at DOJ is leaking Tuesday morning that the sentencing recommendation is being reconsidered. Mm-hmm. Right, senior DOJ officials who would
not
go on the
record. So messaging back to the White House, like, okay, we're on this.
Okay, we're on this. But meanwhile, before the new memo is even filed, all four of the line prosecutors withdraw from the prosecution, and one of them, John Kravis, resigns as an assistant U.S. attorney. The first time I can remember in which all of the government lawyers on a case resigned en masse, clearly in protest of a decision that was made over their heads.
Yeah, I can't think of an example. Now, from a policy perspective, let's unpack the issues that this raises.
Sorry, one more factual development. After all four of them had resigned, a new sentencing memorandum is filed. This one signed by a non-career, or maybe a new career person.
Or just a different person.
Whatever. Basically saying, we're not recommending a particular sentence. We think there should be prison time. But here are all the reasons why the memo we filed yesterday was just ridiculous and aggressive and overly, and we've changed our mind.
So basically, they don't want to put a new number out there because then you have something very specific to contrast. They say something less,
but
that
prison
was too much. But they don't say no, time served.
That's right. Yeah. Now, legally, before we get to the policy, right, because I want to draw a bright line between the law and the policy here.
Yeah.
Legally, the next step is this goes to Judge Jackson, Amy Berman Jackson, the presiding judge in this case, who's already had quite a few run-ins with Roger Stone over gag orders and whatnot.
Yep.
She is under no obligation to accept the revised recommendation.
That's right.
She's under no obligation to accept the first one, and it is fully within her power to refuse to accept the withdrawal of the four prosecutors until she conducts a hearing into the circumstances of their withdrawal. So, you know, the real question to me now legally is, to what extent does Judge Jackson just sort of keep her head down, sentence maybe at the high end of the revised recommendation and go home? Or is she as pissed about all of this as just about everybody else is? And, you know, wants to get on the record exactly what happened. She has the power, theoretically, to compel the attorney general to show up and testify under oath about what happened.
So let's unpack what could happen there, because I don't think she should do that.
Yeah.
I don't think that leads. Let's imagine, what do we think happened here? I think it's just what you said.
Yeah.
The president got unhappy because others are unhappy. He's unhappy himself, Stone's his friend, whatever. And puts pressure on the main DOJ folks, who in turn direct that you got to take this different position.
It's also possible Barr did this all even without a direction
just
from the
White House. But he got the Twitter directive, right, and that's all the directive you need in this administration.
Although, can I say one thing about that before? A lot of folks who have been sort of defending this nonsense, which, by the way, I just don't understand, have been pointing to Carrie Kupek's statement that the front office at DOJ was already reconsidering the recommendation before the president tweeted. And I just want to say, note what that statement doesn't say, right?
It doesn't deny
the possibility that before the tweet, there had been some other communication between the White House and the main and the front office.
So the idea of a hearing to investigate, like, how did this come about, strikes me as pretty problematic, extremely sensitive. It's not remotely clear to me that the hearing would properly be able to elicit the details of communications between the president and the attorney general about this, as a matter of privilege. I also think that even if that were somehow all out there, like, what would we expect to find? It would be that the president said, I think this is a raw deal. The executive power is vested in me.
Yep.
You are all exercising derivative forms of my power, and I want it done this way.
So this is where the law policy thing comes in, right?
Yeah.
So I think you and I both agree, and I think almost everyone who knows what they're talking about agrees, that as a matter of pure constitutional authority, the president absolutely has the power to order the Attorney General, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, and anyone working under them in this capacity, in an exercise of prosecutorial power, to take a particular step, right? That it's, you know, that's not, so, you know, this is not an argument that what the president did is a violation of some statute or is unconstitutional. The argument is that it is incredibly toxic to a critical norm in our constitutional system, which is the idea not of absolute prosecutorial independence, but of sort of default general prosecutorial independence.
So I think we actually totally agree on this, that what we're talking about here is yet another example of one of these immensely important policy and political norms that are not laws and certainly aren't constitutional constraints, but you realize once you have a norm transgressor, as we do, it turns out you might wish they were part of it. And one of those is the relative political insulation of prosecutorial decision making,
especially in the line attorneys in DOJ, U.S. attorneys. And I think it's relevant in this regard that the Stone investigation in particular is a handoff from Mueller, right? Where this all started as an investigation in a context where there was supposed to be actually some meaningful independence, right? Where it was a special counsel who actually was insulated from direct supervision. It's only now in the DC U.S. Attorney's office because Mueller closed up his shop.
Here's the funny thing. So I'm taking the view with you that this is terrible that it was done, but it wasn't some ultra vires or unconstitutional action, if that's how this unfolded. But the president has a whole separate power that's less controversial legally. Right. So if he feels this way, why doesn't he just pardon the guy and put an end to it?
I mean, I actually think that would have been better here. Like, I think it would have been
far less. Oh, I completely agree, because that doesn't transgress the norm in the same way.
I think here's the problem. I think what happened was, well, the other piece of it is, NBC also reported last night that the same thing had actually happened in the Flynn case. It's just that the maneuvering and interference happened before the recommendation was filed, so we never saw it.
Sure.
So the irony here is the only reason why we're even seeing any of this nonsense is because they're incompetent, right? Like, if you know...
Or they no longer care as much.
No, I think somebody in the at Maine Justice
just leaked it.
No. I think the line attorneys, you know, I don't think anyone lied to, like, I don't think it was like phone call to the U.S. attorneys. Hey guys, are you working on the Stone sentencing memo? No, we're not. I think someone at Maine Justice just wasn't paying attention to the fact that this was coming, as opposed to Flynn.
They were more on it. Yeah. Well, there's an. Whatever, no matter how malicious or incompetent you are, there's still a requirement of administering your business.
Well, all right. So, but then I think it's worth taking a minute, because not all of our listeners are lawyers, to talk about why prosecutorial independence is such an important norm, right?
True.
That in the list of norms that we wish were laws but aren't, right? Why prosecutorial independence is so high on the list. So, you know, the way I try to illustrate this to folks is I say, imagine a world where the Justice Department only prosecuted members of the opposing political party for crimes real or imagined, and never prosecuted members of their own political party for crimes real, you know, real and real, right? I don't think that's a world we'd be very happy to live in. I don't think that's a world that's conducive to the rule of law. And yet, if the president can direct, right, individual prosecutorial decisions, including in cases in which he has a personal vested interest, that's the world we're living in.
Yeah, I think that the importance of the norm should be clear enough. It does get tricky if we flip it around and imagine a different time and place in which a hypothetical president is actually the sort of the more trusted figure, and you've got some prosecutor who's the one who has the sort of the policy preferences they're enforcing through selective prosecution. And of course, you might say, well, in that case, that person should be removed.
Yes.
You don't have to then reach in and say, okay, I'm going to micromanage your decisions from the White House.
If the line attorneys are doing their job incorrectly, there are remedies, right? The remedies are to fire them. The remedies are to have their boss, right, the chief of their section or the head of their office, right, step in and take over the case, right? We've been through this. Now, this is not to say that line attorneys at DOJ are perfect, infallible creatures. To the contrary, you and I can cite dozens of cases where line attorneys have gotten overzealous.
Human beings like anybody else.
Right. The problem is that the answer to that, so they're all, you know, as with any other fakakta thing this administration does, all of these folks are coming out of the woodwork to come up with these post hoc rationalizations for why this was perfectly appropriate behavior. And they're all full of crap.
Tell me, are there people offering official accounts saying, look, the reason why it's appropriate to override the line attorneys are there people saying, like, because they made a misjudgment,
yes,
and the higher authorities think that was too harsh?
And they're entitled to their opinion.
But in the abstract, isn't that a permissible position for them to take?
So
let's say it was a narcotics prosecution, and it's way too harsh, and Maine DOJ says, you know what, I don't think so. The element that's different from that fact pattern in this one is the political, personal loyalty interests that are being advanced.
And the appearance of impropriety, right? That in a typical case that is not of high political valence, right, if a U.S. attorney gets if an AUSA gets carried away,
right, it's partiality in the administration of the Justice Department.
Exactly, right. I am not denying the president's power in exceptional cases to assert his authority over his subordinates. I'm not denying that there's a chain of command, right? The problem is that all of these people who are like, the sentence was way harsh, it's totally cool for where are you on all of the other way harsh sentences in our criminal justice system?
Well, exactly. The hypocrisy of some of these complaints.
This is the same president and attorney general who have been talking about how our criminal sentencing isn't draconian enough, right, in like drug cases. So I just, spare me the notion that this is criminal justice reform. This is self-dealing.
Right.
And this kind of self-dealing is exactly the kind of self-dealing that Robert Jackson, in his legendary speech on the federal prosecutor, said is the worst possible thing that can happen to the Justice
Department. It's the sort of thing that is entirely typical of authoritarian regimes.
Yeah.
And there's really nothing more that needs to be said than that.
There isn't. Can I just say one more thing?
Yeah, please.
I have been, as you know, increasingly frustrated by the dwindling number of friends of mine, right, who are not vocally anti-Trump. And I am just trying to figure out what lines are left to cross. Like, what are they waiting for this administration to do before they say, no, you're right. You're right. I, you know, this is a bridge too far. And I just, you know, I understand that there are elected members of Congress who are Republicans who feel the need to kowtow to their base and so have no courage when it comes to standing up to the president. But to everybody else out there, like, what is the line for you if it's not running roughshod over the political, you know, politicizing the Justice Department to a point where you're interfering in cases in which you have a personal interest to protect your friends? Like, what, you know, what is the point of having these institutions after Trump if the legacy that he's leaving is that nothing matters except raw power?
Well, I think you've answered your own question right there. Is the line firing the brother of a whistleblower?
I mean, that's, so this is, you know, this is all coming on the tails of all that stuff, right? So, you know, the all those Republican senators who said, what was it, Susan Collins? You know, I'm sure the president learned his lesson. Yeah, he learned his lesson. Not the one you think.
No, that was in quite a competitive field. That was an Oscar winner worthy baloney or dumb
hubris
statement. So do you want to say anything about the legal protection of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman?
Sure. So, you know, there are two, right? There's both Alex and Yevgeny, right? So Alex Vindman, right, was the NSC staffer who testified, mm-hmm. I think, quite courageously, right, as part of the House Intelligence Committee's investigation and impeachment inquiry. So he and his brother were both fairly unceremoniously forced out of their positions at the White House, on Friday?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to be very clear on this. No one has a right to work at the White House.
Yeah, they weren't fired from their status, they were not, their jobs in the military. They were removed from these assignments.
They were transferred back to their sort of base assignments, right?
Right.
And, you know, in theory, that should not be a possible that you shouldn't be doing that for political retribution.
Right.
That bothers me less, right? Like, if that had been the end of it, I would have said, you know, on the list of Trump's sins, yeah. But the president has since made multiple public comments to the effect that he's not done with them and that they're going to, quote, face discipline within the military for, you know, first of all, right, we're punishing the brother, right, for what the brother did.
Right. So the blood taint is obviously ridiculous. Secretary of Defense Esper, I believe, was quoted saying, we don't allow retaliation or response
2 months
against.
Ago.
Was it 2 months ago? Are you sure?
Esper wrote a letter, right? There's a letter.
I'm thinking about something I thought was a recent quote where he said, no, we don't have retribution against members of our own.
So there's a letter Esper wrote in response to some member of Congress, right, who was concerned about this, where he said, you know, we will do everything, you know, we will protect our own, like, we will take it, right? Esper might have said something else. I haven't seen it.
I could be wrong. So the question is, law protect him?
Well, so first, hold on a second. First, color me skeptical that if the president actually directs Esper to do something. I mean, you know, these are the same people who made similar noises about not restoring Eddie Gallagher's service pin, right? And, I mean, that only cost the Secretary of the Navy his job.
I think that it is not at all obvious if the president says, I want some kind of, Secretary Esper, I want some kind of military proceeding to be initiated. I don't think it's obvious he does that at all.
Well,
I think it's very possible that he would resist that.
Well, especially because in that context, I mean, that is textbook unlawful command influence.
Right. So, I think that, yes, obviously Trump is bloviating about this stuff, but I actually am very doubtful that DOD mm-hmm. institutionally or at its senior ranks is going to go along with anything to go after
these
guys.
So they may not court-martial these guys, right? But if they discipline them in any way, like, that's when I'm going to get really nervous.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it would be terrible, it would be inappropriate, it would be unlawful, and I don't think it's remotely going
to
happen.
All right, so let me refer everybody to the new favorite statute no one had ever heard of before, the Military Whistleblower Act.
Mwah.
So this is 10 U.S.C. section 1034. And so 10 U.S.C. section 1034A, no person may restrict a member of the armed forces in communicating with a member of Congress, period. Now, unless the communication is unlawful. Vindman responded to a congressional subpoena. Guess what? That was not unlawful. 1034B, prohibition of retaliatory personnel actions. No person may take or threaten to take threaten to take. We've already crossed this Rubicon. An unfavorable personnel action or withhold or threaten to withhold a favorable personnel action as a reprisal against a member of the armed forces for making or preparing or being perceived as making or preparing a communication to a member of Congress that under subsection A may not be restricted.
Question, fact, clarification I'm seeking. In addition to or apart from communicating with members of Congress, which is the trigger that covers him and protects him, was Vindman early on in the whistleblowing process also communicating with anyone else?
So there are lots of allegations out there in right-wing conspiracy land.
Yeah, but there's no proof, right?
But there's no evidence of that.
And so as long as he was only communicating with members of Congress, he seems fully under the cover of this protection.
And the Whistleblower Act even goes on specifically to include as one of the things that's protected, testimony, right? Testimony or otherwise participating in or assisting in an investigation. Right. So even if he talks to House Intelligence Committee staffers as part of their investigation, as that wasn't part of his testimony, that's still protected by the Mistletoe Act.
Let's call it that. The Mistletoe Act clearly, if I heard you right, clearly covers the initial whistleblowing act.
Yes.
And even more clearly covers all that follows before. All right. So this is a non-issue. There's no way this is going to go somewhere.
The conspiracy theory is that he leaked classified information in violation of the Espionage Act. And to which my response is, you know, show me a shred of proof that that's true. And until then, shut up.
So
just shut up, everybody.
So I think that it's probably wrong to categorize this as an initiative by the White House that actually is aiming to actually get the formal legal processes of job punishments, et cetera. I think instead it's just another note in the melody of this song that they want to sing that tries to delegitimize and make sound somehow unlawful to counterpunch against the whole effort to criticize what he himself had done. And so the winning move is simply for Trump to make this allegation, to say these things. Hey, this got to be prosecuted. Lock him up. It didn't have to go anywhere beyond that. He's already done the thing he wanted to do.
Okay, but then, I mean, so my concern is, look at how he treats the Vindmans, and look at how he treats Gallagher. What message is he sending to the military about what matters?
Right, no, of course. I assume you don't think that he is intending anything other than exactly the divergence you just point to.
Again.
And in trying to send narrative messages to his base
of the
same kind.
For like the 4,000th time, let me say, my concern is not with Trump. My concern is with all of the sycophants and lackeys who are enabling him.
So I think that's a good note to end on with our Trumplandia segment. Let's talk just quickly, kind of a note on the coronavirus that hopefully we will never actually have to talk about in reference to the quarantine topic.
Yes.
But the other day I wrote something for Lawfare to answer preliminarily.
Highly recommend.
If you're curious about how does the federal quarantine power in particular work, and the first thing to say is that normally quarantine is a state law matter. It's a classic element of the state's police powers. It's the sort of thing that you don't necessarily look to the federal government to be doing. But there is some interesting history here, and so just to kind of lay it out for you, on the possibility that it becomes a bigger issue for us later on, it's obviously become a huge issue in China and in some other places, and we do, in fact, have a few federal quarantines already underway. So how does it work? Historically, the federal government did have a role in implementing quarantines, calling for them and enforcing them. It was all tied up in military readiness. It was all connected to manpower protection during conflict. So you can think of the Spanish flu, but somewhat humorously, not actually that funny, but still a little bit funny. You also, both in World War II and World War I, have these references and actions that were clearly concerns about VD, venereal disease spreading and associated quarantines, some of which, not funny at all, there was at least some legislation that seemed to be designed to provide federal funding and also assistance to civilian or state and local law enforcement, actually imprisoning women as a way to try to prevent, I guess, the spread of VD into military encampments inside the United States. There's some disturbing history there. I don't know the full details of it, but I mentioned that in case it piques your interest. What was less clear was what was the federal authority to create a quarantine power if it was unrelated to the war powers? I think it's clear Congress has, through the necessary and proper clause, the ability to do manpower readiness related quarantining if there's a sufficient nexus with the power to raise and support armies. Separate from that, the federal power to quarantine at the border, I think, is pretty easy to establish, given congressional authority vis-a-vis border crossing matters. What's interesting is whether there is a legitimate congressional role in creating a quarantine power for what we might call internal quarantines that are not
civilians.
Related. Yeah, civilian, unrelated to the military, unrelated to times of war, just there's an outbreak and let's try to contain it. I think that under the pre-Wickard world of the old Interstate Commerce Clause jurisprudence, that was actually a little bit of a tricky question unless you had actual interstate elements. But if it's a local outbreak in a local area, that was just classically left to the states. But of course,
Jacobson versus Massachusetts.
But then you get Wickard, you get all the modern sort of World War II onward innovations in the scope of commerce authority, where you can sort of aggregate just about any kind of activity that ties in with commercial life and show that in aggregate there are interstate spillover effects and therefore Congress can regulate it. And under modern jurisprudence, I think it's surpassingly easy to explain where the power to do it comes from. So have they actually done it? Yes. There is a statute that creates the federal quarantine power. The long and the short of it is it's the CDC director who is specifically authorized to declare that the conditions involving communicable diseases of a certain type. What type? Well, it's delegated to the executive branch to pick them out from time to time and enumerate them in executive orders. So interestingly, you've got some sequence of executive orders over the 1940s up until the Obama administration, which bit by bit add this sort of significant threat and that sort of significant threat. With SARS, SARS itself was added to the list. And then in, I think, 2013 it was, the Obama administration quite wisely recognized that you could get non-SARS similar coronavirus style respiratory syndromes that would pose the exact same threat. And without waiting for that to actually materialize, they went ahead and modified the executive order to list exactly this sort of thing in general. So now in addition to things like typhoid and hemorrhagic fevers, you've now got the whole cluster of coronavirus type respiratory syndromes. And so it's not necessary for the Trump administration to issue a new executive order designating this particular illness. It's already there in the executive order from Obama. All that was needed was for the CDC director to make a determination that in some particular circumstance, we needed to have a quarantine. And he duly did so when Americans began to be repatriated from China on these flights that have brought various groups from abroad to military bases where they are serving out their quarantine time periods. It's interesting to note, you always want to think about a power like this, like, well, what if it's in the wrong hands? What if it's being abused? There are stories about China, for example, possibly abusing its quarantine authority to pretextually detain a critical journalist. So you want to think about, well, how would that be guarded against in our system? The way the statute works is, first of all, the director has to reconsider the director's own decision as to a particular person within 72 hours. And then after that, if the person wants, they can request a medical review. The director is going to pick the doctor or the medical expert who's doing that review. So a lot turns here in the first instance on who you think the director is, what are the qualities of that person, how immune from the prospect of corruption or abuse is that person. Obviously, we have no reason whatsoever to have concerns about the current CDC director, so I don't think we're remotely there. I'm talking only about what could be.
You'd never have a scenario where a president interfered with an agency that, you know, had historically been free from White House interference.
Are you suggesting that you think Trump would... I know you're not suggesting the current CDC director is anything other than a great doctor. Are you suggesting that Trump would be able to get away with removing that person, replacing them with the hack who would do his bidding, and then have that person issue quarantine orders for political purposes?
I mean,
I think even Trump could not possibly pull this off.
Not yet.
Yeah, well, I'll take that then. Right, I'll be right for now, even if not right forever. So then the question becomes, all right, but nonetheless, let's imagine that world. In fact, let's imagine that the coronavirus gets really, really bad inside the United States. And so there's widespread need for real quarantines. And for whatever reason, there's political unrest or it's election related. And under the noise of widespread quarantining, maybe somewhere some one person does get that abusive quarantine treatment. They shouldn't be, but they're quarantined anyways.
Yeah.
What's the legal way out? So these are considered final. Eventually, they become final administrative actions that can be challenged through the Administrative Procedures Act. But of course, you can also bring a habeas action. And the statute actually says nothing in the statute limits your ability to seek judicial review. So then you get to this interesting question about whether and to what extent the factual determination, and this should start to sound familiar to national security law types, what amount of evidence is enough? What's the burden of proof during the habeas process to prove that the person meets the statutory definition of detainability? And it becomes like a Gitmo style thing, but without any guarantee that all the procedural and evidentiary trappings that have been developed over time for Gitmo would carry over into this other context. You would obviously have the executive branch arguing that tremendous comparative institutional competence considerations favor not second guessing the medical doctor, etc. But of course, there'd be a competing medical assessment that would argue the contrary. I guess what I'm suggesting is that the ultimate safeguard against abuse of the federal quarantine power from the legal system's perspective would be habeas litigation.
Yes.
And it would have in the abstract all the same qualities that Gitmo detention litigation.
It's classic executive detention. I mean, it's you know, the hallmark of, and so I've said this before, right, that, you know, Justice Scalia is often, you know, lauded for his dissent in Hamdi about how there's no mechanism to detain U.S. citizens without trial.
Yeah, like absent, it's not true at all.
It's not true at all.
No, the quarantine's the perfect example. And
quarantine is the perfect non-controversial example, right? Because, you know, we may dispute which circumstances rise to the level, but
right, but everyone agrees it exists. Like, no one's out to seem like, no, the government cannot take people's liberty
ever
in that situation. There are people who say that it should be that way. The libertarians might say, like, that just shouldn't be.
Yeah.
But it's clearly
right.
The law of the land.
Yeah. Habeas.
Woo! Well, let's hope all that was entirely academic in all respects.
Listen, we have, I mean, our casebook, as you know, has a detailed discussion of quarantine authorities in the chapter on, you know, Homeland Security. I mean, it's
yeah. Well, when the need is there, this is as serious as a heart attack. One thing I will note, I got very intrigued in talking about what I called the quarantine dilemma.
Uh-huh.
And China's bearing out how this works. And there's a parallel here I want to draw out to counterterrorism and pre-attack interventions to arrest people you think are involved in terrorism. We all know in the counterterrorism context in our circles that there's a trade-off between false positives and false negatives. If you want to really reduce the risk that somebody you think might cause harm eventually will cause harm, then you might be inclined to intervene as early as possible. But the earlier you intervene and depress the risk of a false negative, the greater the chances that you've just erred because you're intervening at a stage where it's less clear what was eventually going to happen. It's the minority report problem.
Yeah.
So you're getting more false positives. And that's a trade-off that's a real dilemma. Quarantine's actually kind of the same way. China did not immediately try to shut down Wuhan and keep all
those
people.
To the contrary, they prosecuted the doctor.
For blowing the whistle.
For blowing the whistle.
Yeah. So they did not intervene super early.
But, you know, politically motivated prosecutions always end well.
So it depends on what time and country, I guess, how well that turns out.
Sorry, I'm just in a mood.
No, I can tell. Come back to me. So China intervenes eventually with a pretty draconian quarantine, but it's much too late. And setting aside that even with the quarantine in place, people are going to slip out anyways. There are a lot of people that left Wuhan long before the quarantine set up. One of our UT colleagues, Dr. Lauren Myers, she and her co-authors produced a study that basically demonstrated, as a matter of data and probabilities, that there's, you know, the following list of 100 plus cities where almost certainly somebody with the disease did get to. So what does that tell you? That earlier quarantine is better. If your only interest is preventing the false negative to make sure you don't have the harm later on, you intervene early. With quarantines, it's even harder, I would submit, to intervene as early as you really would need to be truly effective. In other words, if you only wanted, you didn't care about any other values, no matter how much liberty harm there was, how much economic disruption there was, you could take draconian steps if you thought they were politically sustainable and get a real strong quarantine effect. You'd have so much false positives. And if you're really acting early enough, by the way, the harm wouldn't have really materialized enough to create the political conditions to even do it. So like counterterrorism, counter-epidemic measures run into the same false positives, false negatives trade-off. And again, let's just hope this never actually becomes a more current issue for us
to grapple
with.
But if they do, we'll have Bobby's helpful blog post to start us off.
If we're not all zombies by then.
Well, yeah.
But you know, there's an early episode of the Lawfare podcast where we just pretend there's been a massive zombie outbreak and we go through AUMFs against zombies. And all right, lightning round.
Lightning round. So we promised one of our awesome listeners, we talk a bit about Omar Amin, and this really, I think, fascinating story by Ben Taub in the January 27th issue of The New Yorker. Do you want to say a quick word about... Omar Amin was basically a refugee from Iraq, right? That he actually had come to the United States, at least basically... his cousin, I think, had been affiliated with Al-Qaeda, and he was trying to escape the violence. He was basically trying to find, like, safe haven, right? He ends up in the U.S. as a refugee, even though you have no control if you're a refugee over where you end up. And now, right, the U.S. is seeking to deport him because of what it claims are connections to ISIS. There's a whole fight over sort of, you know, how much meaningful review there is in these cases, like what ability there is to actually challenge the government's assertion that refugees in this country actually don't deserve their refugee status or otherwise subject to deportation. I'm not doing the story justice because it's very long and it's very, I think, disturbing, especially in some of the respects in which it suggests Amin has been mistreated and faces persecution if he's removed. But I think it's an important window into the sort of human side of all of these broad shifts in immigration policy that we talk about sometimes on the podcast, and how, you know, there are very real people in these cases whose lives are, you know, potentially in grave jeopardy if they're removed from this country.
This is a good time to remind everybody how it works when somebody's being removed or returned or moved across the border to the custody of another country. The international law rule is that you can't do this if there's an undue risk that the person will be tortured or otherwise improperly abused upon return, the non-refoulement rule. For the United States, for the British, for lots of countries, one way this is handled is to engage in diplomatic discussions with the receiving country and obtaining so-called diplomatic assurances, that is, written, I guess mostly written, sometimes maybe not, but assurances where the receiving state promises not to cross those lines. And one of the huge issues of sort of circa 2005 to 2012 or so, in that sort of mid to late Bush administration, early Obama administration range, was in connection with extraordinary rendition, when the United States would capture a terrorism suspect in one place and then turn that person over to the custody of another country.
Right.
The question was, in where there was an obvious risk the person might be abused, how could it be consistent with the non-refoulement rule to do it? And sometimes there was litigation, and the answer always was, and the answer the courts ultimately accepted in case after case was, well, the State Department says we raised that issue. They have provided a formal diplomatic assurance. The State Department chooses to credit it, and the claim was that the courts can't second guess that, or at least shouldn't second guess it without further more evidence than they've got.
Yep.
And this became such a flashpoint. So that's where the law kind of settled for the U.S. court's treatment of that issue.
That's basically right. I mean, the one I'll say is so. And Amin's case in particular is an extradition case now. And the, you know, I think way back when at one point we talked about the Ninth Circuit extradition case, Trinidad y Garcia versus Thomas, the Filipino case, where the Ninth Circuit goes en banc and fractures over how you're supposed to litigate a torture slash non-refoulement claim in an extradition proceeding. The controlling rationale of the fractured court was basically what you say, that as long as the State Department signs, or, you know, dots the I's and crosses the T's, it's almost impossible for a, you know, extraditee to overcome the State Department's assertion that may very well be false, right? That the extraditee does not credibly, you know, that there is not a reasonable chance that the extraditee will be tortured or otherwise persecuted if he is returned to his home country, to the requesting country. I have said before that I think those cases are wrong. I think they're wrong as a matter of law because they're under reading what's called the Foreign Affairs Reform and Restructuring Act of 1998, FARA, FARA. But I also think that, like, here's a human...
You should roll your R to indicate the...
FARA. Pedro. this is why I only speak English.
I was about to say. That's awesome.
I don't speak any languages,
including English.
So really, really quickly, I think that this case is sort of a very, I think, riveting and telling human definition of why I think those cases are wrong.
Yeah, I need to spend more time with the article. Oh, yeah. I don't know that the story isn't more complicated than the version that favors him is, but maybe this is exactly right. That's what makes these such compelling cases. We passed over the Iran issue.
Oh yeah,
let's say about this the following. So
this
there's
still going.
There's a lot of talk of late about war powers legislation. I think midday today, this bill associated with Senators Kane, Durbin, Lee, Rand Paul, now Collins as well. So it's kind of a bipartisan Democrats and at least some of the more libertarian Republicans, although then you got Collins as well, kind of coming together around Senate Joint Resolution 68. It strikes me as basically being entirely symbolic.
Yep.
And not actually capable of having much effect. And here's why I say that. The key moving parts, there's two sections. There's a finding section, and then there's actually a part that looks operational because it says section 2, termination of the use of U.S. forces for hostilities against the Islamic Republic of Iran. You got to start with the findings, though. And the findings in relevant parts say we don't have an AUMF that's specifically against Iran, which is true. There's a statement or a finding that purports to say that neither the 01 AUMF or the 02 AUMFs are specific statutory authorizations to use force against Iran, which, depending on what you understand that sentence to mean, is either clearly true or not so clearly true. But I think probably as they've written it, it's true they aren't specific statutory authorizations, and that matters for war powers resolutions. Doesn't mean, though, that they're not relevant in a way that matters constitutionally. In any event, there's then a finding that says that the conflict between, it refers to a currently existing conflict. The conflict between the United States and Iran constitutes, under the War Powers Resolution, either hostilities or a situation where hostilities is clearly indicated. And then it goes on to say U.S. armed forces have been introduced into hostilities. Congress should decide this. And then the operational provision, Congress hereby directs the president to terminate the use of the U.S. armed forces for hostilities against Iran, unless explicitly authorized by a declaration or a specific authorization. Never mind that there's a caveat at the end that we'll get to. But the problem is, what does it really mean to comply with that if it passes?
Right.
Do you have to withdraw your troops from Iraq, from counter-ISIS operations? It's pretty clear to me, at least, that the 01 and 02 AUMFs would still be cited as the basis for being there for other purposes. And the government would simply say, we are not currently deployed in a way that depends on the Iran target, but does depend on the ISIS target, at least, if not also other problems now emerging in Iraq with instability there. So I don't think this is written in a way that actually is even designed to compel an actual withdrawal. I don't think the authors are trying to get us to pull our forces out of Syria and Iraq, otherwise they would say so. But if you don't pull those forces out of Syria and Iraq altogether, then it won't change anything on what really matters, which is our forces are there periodically, if and when there's either a basis, good faith or otherwise,
right,
to say that Iran is about to attack them or has just attacked them, or we have a long train of attacks upon them, then self-defense arguments, which have been made in connection with Soleimani and will continue to be made in these contexts in the future, no doubt, will continue to be made, and this legislation won't change that in the slightest. And the fact that
is the only way that it has a chance of passing.
Well, exactly, right. Well, that's right. And I get it. Like, I understand that people moving the legislation know these things. There's even a caveat at the end of the legislation that says nothing in this section shall be construed to prevent the United States from defending itself from imminent attack.
There we go.
Which sounds strict until you know how, over the years, imminent is a term of art that's been construed to mean continuous and ongoing streams of attack, not just the things that are literally imminent in a layperson's understanding of that ordinary word. So I think it's actually nonetheless meaningful symbolism.
Meaningful symbolism, but empty formalism.
Or practically ineffectual, but symbolically effectual.
Listen, as I said before, I'm all for Congress reasserting itself over the war powers. But, you know,
yeah,
on the theory that there's infinite capital, I don't mind measures like this. On
yeah.
the theory that there is not infinite capital,
exactly.
Come on.
And I would add that it will seem to ordinary human beings
like they did
hearing
something.
This that they did something that they didn't really do.
Correct.
So I think that's actually corrosive.
Woohoo!
Yep.
So, you know, in various episodes in the past, we've talked about my many, many ongoing cases that really aren't that good of an idea because they take away too much time, and Karen hates me. So there have been developments in two of interest. One, remember Larrabee?
Oh, yeah.
Right? So the our challenge to the lawfulness of trying retired service members before courts-martial.
Referenced not that long ago on this show.
So the Supreme Court had denied cert in our direct appeal in Larrabee last February. We had turned around and filed a civil suit, a collateral attack on Larrabee's conviction in D.C. Federal District Court. We filed it in March. There had been a little bit of motions practice culminating with the government moving to dismiss and us moving for judgment on the pleadings that had all ended in May. And then we hadn't heard anything for a while. So this Saturday afternoon, I'm at the Texas Tech basketball game when I get an ECF notification.
Oh, no. The electronic court filing system Indeed. Notification.
At 4:30 on a Saturday afternoon,
That's not cool.
The district judge, who shall remain nameless, issued an order scheduling a motions hearing for 17 days from then, which is now, you know, less than 2 weeks from today, 13 days from now, February 25th,
Road trip.
So, you know, after nothing happening on the docket for like, 10 months, we get a Saturday afternoon order for a motions hearing in 13 days.
That is, them's the breaks when you use litigating.
Well, this is true. So I get to tick something off my bucket list. It'll be the first time I've ever argued a motion.
Is that right?
I've never argued in a district court. I've gone backwards. I started at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, you're working your way down the list.
And then the Court of Appeals.
I'll have you know that I am undefeated in motion practice in district courts.
1-0?
I am 1-0. It's not 0-0. I'm 1-0.
No, undefeated implies a victory.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It's not like the Hampshire football t-shirts, undefeated since 1984. No. You got to win at least one.
You got to be capable of being defeated.
That's right. Yeah, well said. So that's Larrabee. So I expect we
Congratulations.
Will actually get, well, we'll see. We'll get some kind of ruling on the government's motion to dismiss and our motion for judgment on the pleadings at some point. Briggs, the Supreme Court case I'm now arguing on March 23rd. They set the argument date since last we saw each other. We filed our merits brief today, which was
congratulations.
Thank you. My very, very first ever counsel record respondent merits brief.
And what color would said brief
so
be?
So this is what I was telling Bobby before the show. This is the stupidest, nerdiest thing to be excited about. But with this brief, I have now hit all 9 of the possible colors of Supreme Court briefs as counsel of record.
Aside, except the one that
so
only...
there's one right. So there are actually so trivia question, listeners. There are 10 different colors of briefs in the Supreme Court, but one is only filed by the government, and I don't really see a future as the Solicitor General of the United States.
So let's give a shout out here, Jen Daskal and Alex Joel and Gary Korn have got. I believe it's called the Tech Law and Security. The Center for Tech Law and Security, is that it, or some combination of those? Anyways, what a team. What an amazing team. They're hosting a launch event tomorrow afternoon. I'll be on a panel with some wonderful folks, moderated by Ellen Nakashima. We're going to be talking about disinformation and cyber operations, election protection, the whole nine yards. I'm really excited to see everybody there. The first place we did a live podcast. And so your former school and
my former stomping grounds. All right. Well, on that note, he is at Bobby Chesney. I am at Steve_Vladek. We are at NSL Podcast. Oh, boy. Stay safe out there.
Adios.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Bobby and Steve for sending us this audio. If you found this podcast useful, please give us a 5-star rating and review on the podcast app of your choice. The Lawfare Podcast is produced by Jen Patia Howell. I was your editor this week, and our music, which we don't have on special editions, is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.